Let's take a more detailed view of the day's biggest stories now, including the latest from Syria, where there's been that powerful car bomb in the capital, Damascus, and from Jerusalem, where Israeli and Palestinian footballers are planning to join forces for a special match. You're listening to World Briefing with Maddie Savage in London, where it's just past 7 o'clock in the evening. First, though, let's go straight to South Africa, where the third day of the bail hearing for Oscar Pistorius finished a few hours ago. If the case wasn't already dramatic enough, the Paralympic star's accused of shooting dead his girlfriend, there's been an unexpected and extraordinary new development. It's emerged that the leading detective on the case, Hilton Botha, is himself facing charges of attempted murder. He's accused of firing at a minivan with seven people in it 2 years ago in an attempt to stop it. The charges against him had been dropped, but they were reinstated just this month. Now he's being replaced as the top officer on the Oscar Pistorius case. Here's South Africa's Police Commissioner, Ria Fiega.
As the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service, I have decided to assign this very important matter, this very important investigation, under the leadership and stewardship of the Divisional Commissioner of Detective Services, Lieutenant General Munyu. He is the most senior detective in the SAPS environment.
Our correspondent Nomsa Maseko was following the bail hearing as it unfolded in court in Pretoria. I spoke to her a short time ago.
Every day since this bail hearing started, we have been seeing drama. We have been seeing feisty exchanges made between the state and the defense. And today was no different when revelations came about that investigating officer Hilton Botha had been facing seven counts of attempted murder. And, you know, a lot of questions have been asked about, you know, the convenience thereof, of the fact that it's only today that these attempted murder charges have come about. But the National Prosecuting Authority did say this morning that it finds it impossible that this police officer should still be reinstated. And that decision to remove him was the police's decision to remove him, because if he was not removed, it could have dealt a blow in the credibility of the state's case.
And so where does this leave Oscar Pistorius's case? Where is his bail hearing up to now?
Well, the ruling in this bail hearing was expected today, but, you know, the dramatic turn of events in the proceedings means that Oscar Pistorius will spend at least another night in a police cell before he knows whether or not he will be granted bail. And from what we have been hearing from the prosecutor is that he says he needs at least 1 hour to wrap up his argument tomorrow. Therefore, we could be hearing judgment by late Friday afternoon.
Nomsa Maseko speaking to me from Pretoria. Let's move on now. And twin bomb explosions have hit the southern Indian city of Hyderabad, killing and injuring many people. The blasts hit at a crowded market area in the early evening. Our correspondent Omar Farooq is in the city and he joins me now. Omar, do we know any more about why Hyderabad was attacked?
Well, Hyderabad has traditionally been one of those cities which were targeted by the terrorists in the past. And in the present case, though, the officials and the government have not been able to pin the blame on any particular organization or group. But it is obvious, and police officials are saying so, that it was a very well-coordinated and well-planned terrorist attack. The area chosen for today's attack was, targeted in the past, too. In 2007, Hyderabad had seen a similar serial blast. And one of the bombs which were planted in this particular area failed to explode, and it was deactivated in time. But today, the people of the area were not so lucky, and during the evening rush hour, two blasts exploded one after the other. Why it happened at this juncture? Well, the Union Home Minister says that the government had a prior warning that terrorists might attack. 2 days back, they had given this warning to all the state governments. And security officials are saying that they are seeing this blast in the context of recent hanging of one Afzal Guru, a convict in the attack on Indian Parliament in 2001.
And so, Omar, how are people reacting? You mentioned officials briefly there, but what about the government and people living in Hyderabad?
Well, the situation was very tense ever since the blasts took place. And all the shops were closed. People, you know, ran back to their homes. And it was a very, very difficult situation on the roads. Traffic was completely jammed and some of the roads were closed by the police. And everybody is waiting for the daybreak now. It's almost midnight now. And people are just waiting for the daybreak in the hope that they will have a clear picture. Government is avoiding naming somebody or some organization in today's case because of the past experience. In 2007, when bomb exploded in a mosque, they were quick to blame it on Pakistan-based terrorist organizations. And it turned out to be handiwork of some local Hindu right-wing organizations. So the government doesn't want to land itself in that situation again, and they are moving very cautiously.
Okay, Omar Farooq, we need to leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us from Hyderabad. Well, meanwhile, a powerful car bomb has exploded in the Syrian capital, Damascus. It was detonated near the headquarters of the ruling Ba'ath Party. At least 53 people died, including 15 soldiers. Jean-Pierre Duthion, who's a French expatriate living in the city, has been to the scene of the blast.
It's totally difficult to imagine because it was full of smoke, very thick black smoke, and the air was totally unbreathable because you have an awful smell of flesh burned, and you can see people scratch all over the place, and you can see burned meat everywhere, and it's very difficult to imagine. The people, most of them, they were under shock, definitely, because the explosions just happened. People were totally afraid. You have people running, you have cars trying their best to escape.
Well, so far, no one's taken responsibility for the attack. Earlier, we spoke to Edgar Jalla, the BBC Arabic TV editor, for more on what happened.
This attack targeted a very sensitive area. We are talking about three blasts here. One that happened very close to the ruling Ba'ath Party. And it's quite significant. This is a clear message to the president that we are very close to you. And the second one was very close to the Russian embassy. We think that this is another message also sent to Russia. And it comes in line of previous attacks that targeted intelligence headquarters since last July when Asif Shaukat, the president's brother-in-law, was killed in these attacks. So these are a continuation of a series of messages sent to the regime by the opposition that we can get even closer to you day after day.
Well, meanwhile, in Cairo, in Egypt, discussions have opened with the view of Syria's opposition holding talks with President Assad's regime. Here's the BBC's Edgar Jalad again.
Now we are in the process of, they are trying to find a peaceful solution. That means that no one has reached the stage where he considered that he can win this battle. So neither President Assad nor the opposition feel like they are very close to the final victory. So that's why they keep on sending messages and hitting very sensitive areas just to amend a little bit the balance of power. But it will not affect him since the President Assad is still in control of around at least 60% of the army.
Edgar Jalad from BBC Arabic speaking to me earlier. Now, the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, says that Iran has for the first time begun installing advanced machines for enriching uranium at its plant at Natanz. Enriched uranium can be used for nuclear fuel or to make an atomic bomb. Iran, though, still insists its nuclear work is purely peaceful. Joining me now is Borzog Sharafeddin from the BBC's Persian service. Tell us more about the findings of this latest report.
In this report, I can say that there are some good news for the West and some bad news. The good news is that Iran has converted some of its highly enriched uranium into fuel for medical purpose. But the bad news is that Iran still has 170 kilos of highly enriched uranium. And I should mention here that the red line, for example, for Israel for enriched uranium by Iran is 240 kilos. And it has warned that Iran, if Iran reaches that line, it would attack Iran. So Iran is not that far from Israel's red line. And another bad news is this new generation of centrifuges. This is the first time that Iran is upgrading its centrifuges. And these centrifuges can enrich uranium much faster, maybe two or three times.
So that's the key thing that's different then from previous inspections of what's been happening in Iran. So how could this affect crucial talks happening next week between Iran and world powers on this very issue?
Yes, I mean, we should know that Iran and IAEA talks is kind of independent from Iran and 5+1 talks. But they affect each other all the time. And IAEA reports is full of defiant steps by Iran. And I was talking yesterday by an American official, and she said that they are kind of angry with such defiant steps. And ahead of talks, they see such installations of especially they were angry with these new centrifuges that Iran is installing. And they clearly saw that as a defiant step. And they said they are putting together new sanctions if talks are not fruitful.
OK, Borzog Sharafeddin from the BBC's Persian service, thanks very much for bringing us up to date on that. Here in Britain, three men have been found guilty of leading a terrorist bomb plot that police believe could have been bigger than the London Underground attacks in 2005. Irfan Nasir, Irfan Khalid and Ashik Ali, all from Birmingham, were described as central figures in a plot to set off rucksack bombs in crowded areas. The men were arrested back in 2011 after an extensive surveillance campaign by West Midlands Police. Our Home Affairs correspondent June Kelly was in court.
These three men were born and brought up in Birmingham, but the court heard they had grown to despise the British. Their conversations were being bugged, and the ringleader, Irfan Nasir, attacked the 77 London bombers for not causing enough carnage. The men and a number of their associates were arrested after a joint operation involving the security service MI5 and West Midlands Police Counter-Terrorism Unit. Outside the court after today's verdicts, Assistant Chief Constable Marcus Beale spoke of the threat posed by the group.
We are a whole lot safer having had these verdicts. These group and a wider group, I think, posed a particular threat in the UK. They planned on planting a lot of bombs, some suicide bombs, where they were looking to kill and maim lots and lots of people.
Irfan Nasir and his right-hand man, Irfan Khalid, had travelled to Pakistan for terrorism training. But from the moment they arrived back at Birmingham Airport, they were under surveillance. Nasir began to try to recruit others to the cell. The plot involved detonating up to 8 rucksack bombs. Although they didn't discuss specific targets, in police interviews, the third man convicted today, Ashik Ali, said they had talked about donning suicide vests and using bombs and guns to slaughter British soldiers.
Malian troops have been battling Islamist fighters in the northern city of Gao, which was seized from rebel control by French-led forces last month. There have been prolonged exchanges of fire around the mayor's office. It's some of the most sustained fighting since the rebels were driven out of the urban centres in northern Mali, largely without a fight. Here's Grant Ferret from our Africa desk.
This wasn't the first attack on Gao since the French military spearheaded a rapid advance through northern Mali late last month. But the prolonged and intense nature of the fighting will concern the Malian army and its French backers. Much of the fighting was concentrated around local government buildings in Gao. A Malian army commander in the city said up to 40 jihadists had entered under cover of darkness.
We're dealing with an infiltration from last night, the commander said. Just before the power was cut, some elements entered Gao and are trying to take this building. Well into the afternoon, the shooting was still going on, largely around the mayor's office. One of the Islamist groups which controlled northern Mali for most of last year, Mujao, said it was behind the attack and would continue to fight until it had, in its words, liberated Gao. Just 10 days ago, French troops stepped up patrols and strengthened checkpoints around the city in response to a previous attack. Clearly, they have more work to do. And with an apparent suicide bombing in another northern town, Kidal, and a planned African intervention force still not at full strength, there are now real questions about the stated ambition of the French government to withdraw its troops from Mali within weeks.
You're listening to World Briefing on the BBC World Service. Police in Singapore say they're in contact with a suspect accused of running a global football match-fixing network. In a short statement, the police said the man, who's commonly known as Dan Tan, is helping with their investigations. He's wanted by authorities, including those in Italy, and he's been linked with scores of fixed football games around the world. From Kuala Lumpur, here's our correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
Dan Tan Seet Eng's name has appeared frequently on police reports into global football corruption. Alleged to be at the centre of a sophisticated match-fixing network, the few reports about Dan Tan have suggested that despite his wealth, he has continued to live a simple life in Singapore. As interest grew in match-fixing worldwide, questions began to be asked as to why the Singaporean authorities weren't detaining him. It's still not clear whether Dan Tan was arrested or if he's helping the police voluntarily. A statement said he was currently assisting the authorities in their investigations, and a spokesman refused to give any further details. Earlier in the day, a Slovenian believed to be a close aide of Dan Tan arrived in Italy from Singapore and gave himself up to the police. He is expected to be charged with sporting fraud.
We move to China now, and the senior communist politician Bo Xilai, who was sacked by his party last year, is now apparently on hunger strike in detention, according to reports by the Reuters news agency. It says that unnamed sources claim he's refusing to cooperate with investigators who are looking into allegations of corruption and abuse of power. From Beijing, here's our China correspondent Damien Grammaticus.
Bo Xilai was one of the Chinese Communist Party's most high-profile, popular and ambitious men. He was sacked last year amid claims his wife had murdered a British businessman. Since then, he's been held in secret by party investigators. Quoting two separate sources with ties to Bo Xilai's family, the Reuters news agency says Mr. Bo has been on hunger strike twice while in detention. One source said Mr. Bo had to be force-fed and was taken to hospital in Beijing for treatment. The second added Mr. Bo is refusing to answer questions from investigators and won't shave, so he now has a beard down to his chest. There have been no formal charges against him made public, no legal process, just lurid allegations in state media that he's guilty of massive corruption, abuse of power and having many mistresses. No date has been set for a trial. Bo Xilai's downfall engulfed the Communist Party in scandal, exposing infighting at the top, just as the party was preparing for a once-in-a-decade leadership change last November. Many observers believe powerful rivals used the opportunity to oust Mr. Bo, who was a candidate for a leadership job. The man who emerged from the reshuffle as the Communist Party's new leader, Xi Jinping, a longtime rival of Mr. Bo, is due to be confirmed as China's new president next month. The party is, it seems, waiting until after this leadership change is complete to confront the divisive and potentially difficult issue of how to bring Bo Xilai to court.
One of the Western Hemisphere's most notorious former leaders, Jean-Claude Duvalier of Haiti, also known as Baby Doc, has failed to attend a crucial court hearing about human rights abuses under his rule in the 1970s and 80s. Relatives of some of the hundreds of people killed or tortured by Baby Doc's militias are trying to charge him with crimes against humanity. Our international development correspondent Mark Doyle reports.
The courtroom in the capital, Port-au-Prince, was packed. Relatives of victims seeking justice, lawyers in black robes, human rights observers and journalists. But the 61-year-old Baby Doc Duvalier, that name from the past which Haitians can never forget, didn't turn up. At the last minute, he filed an appeal in another court, which his lawyer said excused him from what would have been the first time he'd ever faced his victims in public. A well-known Haitian human rights lawyer, Mario Joseph, said Duvalier is trying to control the justice system like he did when he was a dictator. He may succeed. In Haiti, it's widely thought that the courts are controlled by politicians. The current Haitian government is close to the Duvalier family. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights said Mr. Duvalier should face justice. But unless the UN itself arrests him and takes him to the International Criminal Court, it's looking unlikely that will happen.
We return to India now, and a 21-year-old woman who punched a man she said was harassing her is now being investigated for unprovoked assault in the state of Kerala. The student's case is making headlines across the country. Farhana Dawood's been following the story.
Amrutha Mohan led a motorbike rally at a 1 billion rising event in Kerala last week. The international program of events was aimed at bringing an end to violence against women. But on her way back home, she ran into a spot of bother with some men. Amrutha, who's trained in martial arts, says a group of men were using vulgar language towards her. Her father intervened but was pushed to the ground by one of them. She then hit back, she says, to save her father. Her tormentor fled. Amrutha filed a complaint against the men at a police station. However, to her horror, she's now facing a police investigation. Her tormentor has lodged a complaint against her for unprovoked assault.
He has registered a case against me that I have broken his nose. Something has happened to his nose. But yesterday he has given a live interview. I think he has called a press meet or something. He hasn't even put a band-aid on his nose.
Amrutha's case is gaining nationwide attention in India. Unprecedented protests across the country last December following the gang rape and murder of a female medical student in Delhi has meant the authorities are under a lot more pressure to act on the almost routine violence against women.
The Israeli president and the president of Barcelona Football Club have announced a plan for a match between a joint team of Israelis and Palestinians and the Spanish side. It will take place at the end of July at the Ramat Gan Stadium in Israel. From Jerusalem, Yilantanel reports.
Support for Barcelona Football Club unites football fans on both sides of the Israel-Palestinian conflict. Now the president of the club, who's here visiting Israel and the West Bank for the first time, says that Barca wants to help build bridges of understanding and harmony through sport. It's not yet known who'll make the final lineup, but this summer's exhibition game will bring together top Israeli and Palestinian players to face the Barcelona side. There are high hopes that star striker Lionel Messi will be among the visitors. Last year, Barcelona became inadvertently embroiled in Middle Eastern politics. The former Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who was held by Palestinian militants in Gaza for over 5 years, was a guest at its Nou Camp stadium for the match against arch-rivals Real Madrid. When Palestinians expressed anger, an invitation was also extended to a footballer on their national side, who was imprisoned for 3 years without charge by Israel. However, he chose not to attend.
A quick reminder of our top story this hour. The lead investigator in the case against the South African athlete Oscar Pistorius is being replaced after it emerged that he faces attempted murder charges. There's much more on that story at bbc.com/news, including a timeline as it happened, all the details from day 3 of the hearing.